We're going to begin today with, as is our custom, a couple of readings. I've selected a couple of texts from Proverbs. The first comes from the Contemporary English Bible. This is the 14th chapter of Proverbs, verses 6 through 8. Make fun of wisdom, and you will never find it. But if you have understanding, knowledge comes easily. Stay away from fools, or you won't learn a thing. Wise people have enough sense to find their way, but stupid fools get lost. And now from the Common English Bible, as opposed to the Contemporary English Bible, this is the 17th verse of the 27th chapter of Proverbs. As iron sharpens iron, so one person sharpens a friend. And I would also like to share with you one line from a play by Lorraine Hansberry called The Sign in Sidney Grustein's Window. This was the last play she ever wrote. She died in her 30s of cancer, and she knew she was dying as she was writing the play. It's set in Greenwich Village in New York City in the 1960s, and it's this odd assortment of people who are very much, they're a mixture of cynicism and idealism, and they are working very hard for progressive changes in society and also personal happiness, and I'm not doing a terribly good job with either one. But this is Sidney Grustein. The why of how we are here is an intrigue for adolescents. The how is what must command the living.
All right. Morning, folks. As I was just telling Clara a few minutes ago, this is like my third performance this weekend. And the other two, I was like for hours and hours, I was singing my own song. So, you know, I decided today I'm going to sing somebody else's song. So this is a song by the great Daryl Scott called Great Day to Be Alive. I got rice cooking in the microwave. I got a 3-day beard. I don't plan to shave. It's a goofy thing, but I just gotta say, hey, I'm doing all right. Yeah, I think I'll make me some homemade soup. Feeling pretty good, and that's the truth. It's neither a drink or a drug induced. I'm just doing all right. And it's a great day to be alive. I know the sun's still shining when I close my eyes. Hard times in the neighborhood, but why can every day be just this good? It's been 15 years since I left my home. Said good luck to every seed I'd sown. Gave it my best and I left it alone. Oh, I hope they're doing all right. Now, red bird, what do I see? A lone wolf there staring back at me. Long in the tooth, but harmless as can be. I guess he's doing all right. And it's a great day to be alive. You know the sun's still shining when I close my eyes. Some hard times in the neighborhood, why can every day be just this good? Sometimes it's lonely, sometimes it's only me and the shadows that fill this room. Sometimes I'm calling, desperately calling, howling at the moon. It's a colorful life that we go through. It's either black or white, only shades of blue. Maybe I'll grow me a Fu Manchu. Nah, it's a great day to be alive. alive. You know the sun's still shining when I close my eyes. It's a hard times in the neighborhood, but why can't every day be just this good? It's a good day to be alive. I know the sun's still shining when I close my eyes. It's a hard times in the neighborhood. Why can't everything be just this good?
Thank you, Doug, and we will look forward to hearing from you again when I'm done running my mouth. I've titled today's reflection, Our Heretical Pedigree, and it's something of a retread, which you'll understand in a minute. There was an opinion piece in the News and Record a couple of weeks ago by a woman named Jillian Richards. The headline was, Decline in Religion Hurts Self-Government. Now, Ms. Richards works for the Heritage Foundation, so I don't think it will surprise you to learn that I find much of what she writes to be simplistic or dangerous or both. But the piece has provoked several letters to the editor in the days since it was published, either extolling its wisdom or decrying its ignorance. She quotes a number of the founding fathers and cites a number of statistics, one of which is that in 2007, there were about 5 Christians for every 1 non-religious person. Now that ratio is about 2 to 1. One can draw several conclusions from that statistic. I think we can tell what Ms. Richards concludes, but I think she's mistaken. In fact, if that declining ratio means that Americans are figuring out the big con of many religious leaders, then I say, bravo, well done, good and faithful servants. Richards invoking the founding fathers is something of a con as well. She cherry-picks from George Washington and John Adams, so I will too. Here's Washington in a private letter from 1792. Of all the animosities which have existed among mankind, those which are caused by a difference of sentiments in religion appear to be the most inveterate and distressing and ought to be most deprecated. And here's a passage from the Treaty of Tripoli signed by President John Adams in 1796. The government of the United States of America is not in any sense founded on the Christian religion. I'll throw in 2 blurbs from Thomas Jefferson for good measure. This is from a transcript of a trial in Virginia. Christianity neither is nor ever was part of the common law. And from the Virginia Statute for Establishing Religious Freedom that was in the House of Delegates, which Jefferson drafted, our civil rights have no dependence on our religious opinions any more than our opinions in physics or geometry. So why this decline that so worries the author of the Heritage Foundation? I think Robin Myers says it best. He's a now retired pastor of a congregation of the United Church of Christ in Oklahoma. He visited with us, I think it was around 2010. It was shortly after the publication of his book, Saving Jesus from the Church. He puts it this way. It's as if all at once people no longer feel like pretending to believe things they know are not true in order to get rewards they secretly doubt are available. Faith is not about believing stuff in order to get stuff. What's dangerous is that there are religious leaders and other public and political figures who seem so fearful of losing their places of privilege and prominence and power that they've become less concerned with defending religious liberty than they are with asserting religious authority. Let me suggest to you that in some circles, at least, we have the beginnings of our very own American Taliban, who demonize education, deny science, are unmoved by facts, are undeterred by new information, are intolerant of dissent, and have a pathological need to control women's bodies. So, this morning, I'd like to remind us of our theological pedigree, which stands athwart the positions of Ms. Richards and her ilk, and refer back to some thoughts that were first articulated by Jim Dollar, a previous pastor that many of us remember. He called them the six theses. Now, in the interest of full disclosure, I should acknowledge that I've shared a version of this message before, maybe 10 years ago, with Jim's blessing. But it seems to me that, first of all, if a message is worth hearing once, it might be worth hearing again. And especially in light of our present cultural environment and the major changes that we anticipate in our congregation in the coming months, maybe it's good for us to remind ourselves of where we've come from. You can be the judge of that, but here we go. There are six statements which, if affirmed, will transform Christianity as we know it. They are, number one, our idea of God is not God. This is the truth from which all the rest flow. Number two, the church was before the Bible. Three, every step forward is a step into heresy. Number four, the Garden of Eden did not have latitude and longitude. Number five, we are the ones who say so. And six, ants find the picnic, flowers turn to the light. Back to number one. Our idea of God is not God. What could be more self-evident? My idea of God is different from Mark's idea of God, which is different from Joyce's idea of God, or Clara's idea of God, or Nancy's idea of God. And none of us can comprehend the mystery of the entirety of the mystery of God, either individually or as a group. And yet, the church is often speaking as though it is the spokesperson for God. The church declares this and denounces that and tells us that if we don't do things the way the church tells us to do, we're going to hell, all in the name of God. It's as though the church is God. Certainly, it's as though the church's idea of God is God. What utter hubris. No. Our idea of God is not God, no matter who we are. It gets even stranger. The church can acknowledge that God is beyond all human understanding, that our idea of God is not God. But the church is so reluctant to entertain new ideas about God. Although that may be changing, given the declining numbers Ms. Richards is so concerned about, and the efforts of organizations like Progressive Christianity, which we can claim a special allegiance to, given the leadership role that our Reverend Dr. Sandman plays in it, and events like the Wild Goose Festival, where he is this weekend. But another issue with our idea of God is the almost universal depiction of God as being gendered, and that gender being male. Now, it's true that the names of God in the Bible, the Hebrew Bible, Elohim, or authority, Shaddai, Almighty, or Adonai, Master, those are all male. And Jesus is described as referring to God as Father. But do you remember your French or Spanish grammar from high school? All nouns have, in those languages and many languages, are gendered. They're either masculine or feminine. And the gender of the noun has nothing to do with biological gender. Hebrew is like that. Nouns are either masculine or feminine. So it's true that all those names for God are masculine nouns, but there is Ruach Elohim, the Spirit of God. That's a feminine noun. So is Shekinah, the presence of God, another feminine noun. It seems to me that portraying the Israelites' image of God as exclusively male bespeaks a willful failure to embrace all that they believed God to be. Sadly, most Christians have embraced the same limited view, one not shared, thank goodness, by our pastor. Actually, living out of the realization that our idea of God is not God would change many things overnight, and that goes for many faith traditions. Number two, the church was before the Bible. Of course, the church was before the Bible. Abraham was before the Bible. Moses was before the Bible. The prophets were before the Bible. Jesus and the apostles and the early Christian church were before the Bible. The writings that are in the Bible because the church decided they should be in the Bible. The writings that are not in the Bible are not in the Bible because the church decided they should not be in the Bible. The Bible is what it is because the church decided that's what it should be. The church created the Bible, and the process was pretty fraught. In the Roman Catholic tradition, the New Testament canon wasn't officially adopted until the Council of Trent, and the formal vote to close the canon took place on April 8, 1546. The tally? 24 yea votes, 15 nay votes, and 16 abstentions. So what that means is the New Testament as we have it today reflects the theology of 44% of the Council Fathers. You'll note no Council Mothers. The larger point is that when you read the Bible, you read what the church wants you to read. What the church doesn't want you to read is called heretical, which is particularly interesting for reasons we'll get to in a minute. But in the meantime, if you find yourself in a curious or, dare I say, heretical mood, you might check out the Gospel of Thomas, or the Gospel of Mary, or the Gospel of Judas, or the letter of Barnabas, or the Acts of Paul and Thecla. Understanding that the church was before the Bible changes the foundation of authority. Now, when the church says, the Bible says, we can ask, what should the Bible say? Of course, to talk like this is to sound like the worst sort of heretic, which gets us rather nicely to number three. Every step forward is a step into heresy. Every religious doctrine that is embraced with such fervor and conviction was at one point in the history of religion utter heresy. Jesus was called a blasphemer and a heretic by the religious authorities of his day. The apostles followed, and followers of Jesus were persecuted by the Jews in Jerusalem for continuing and deepening the heresy of Jesus. Rome considered early Christianity to be heretical and dangerous. The Roman Catholic Church saw the Protestant Reformation as blasphemous and heretical. Heresy is our heritage and our hope. That heritage includes at least eight different Christian variants which identify as Presbyterian. Number four, the Garden of Eden did not have latitude and longitude. The Garden of Eden was not a historic, literal, actual place. The creation story in the Bible stands alongside other creation stories from other cultures. There was no time of perfect obedience or perfect innocence or moral perfection. There was no primordial paradise from which we were expelled for disobeying God. And so there was no original sin which required the atoning death of God's only Son to patch things up so that we could get back in God's good graces if we confess, repent, and believe. There was no fall. There was nothing to fall from. Now you understand what this means, right? We just got rid of original sin. Once we do that, we have to rethink who Jesus was and what the meaning is for us of his life and death and resurrection appearances. Everything changes when our idea of original sin changes. Number five. We are the ones who say so. We decide. We choose. We believe what we believe because we believe what we believe is worth believing. How do we know? We don't. Why do we take it on faith? Why do we take on faith what we take on faith and not something else? We just do. We decide. We choose. And actually, this idea is particularly Presbyterian. Being a Presbyterian means being responsible for asking and seeking and knocking, for deciding for ourselves what we will think, say, and do. There are multiple references in the Presbyterian Book of Order to the sanctity of the individual conscience. Even in the Westminster Confession of Faith, we find these words, God alone is Lord of the conscience, and have left it free from the doctrines and commandments of men. being around authority in matters of faith and practice is a daunting responsibility. Life is never more difficult than deciding for ourselves in challenging situations what is good and what we will do in service of those decisions we make. It takes practice. Performing artists and athletes practice a lot in order to perform a little. We would do well to practice living so as to embrace diversity, exhibit inclusiveness, and extend hospitality to everyone so that working together, we can fine-tune our sense of who God is and who God is asking us to be in order to discover our life's path and then walk that path with intention, good humor, clarity, wisdom, compassion, and grace. And when we get it wrong, and we do and we will, we have to stop and start over again in a new direction. This is where the rest of us come in. We can't just listen to ourselves or those who agree with us. We need to hear different points of view. That's the wonder of community. When we speak from the heart about things that matter and listen deeply to one another, the experience can be transformative. As iron sharpens iron, so one person sharpens a friend. We learn from each other and grow together. I believe that it's in those moments that we find the best example of the church as it ought to be. Number 6, ants find the picnic, flowers turn to the light. Sidney Brustein is right. It's how we live and treat each other that commands our living. Mark wonderfully explored that idea in his message last week. But much traditional theology teaches that we cannot do what is good without being threatened into doing it. That without being made to be good, we would be evil. And never mind the fact that Christianity launched the Crusades, justified slavery, burned heretics at the stake, and drowned witches. We are taught to believe that without the specter of hell, it all goes to hell. So much of our culture has embraced this threat mentality, and politicians are among the worst offenders. I contend that most current political rhetoric has very little to do with solving society's problems. It has two goals, and two goals only: making us afraid of something and telling us who's to blame for it. Sad to say, but that's often how elections are won. More than anything else, I believe that the most important countercultural thing the church as it ought to be can offer to our society is to be the picnic and the light for the ants and the flowers. We can seek to embody the truth that all life is connected and interdependent, that all creation is one, that the Ruach Elohim, that wonderful feminine noun from earlier, meaning God's spirit, is in each and every one of us. It's in all creation, even those who have been deemed our enemies. So what tools do we need to live in this way? Some of you can say this with me: eyes to see, ears to hear, and hearts that understand. Those things do not come from indoctrination. They are not the result of keeping rules. Seeing, hearing, and understanding lead to lives that are well lived in the fullest sense of the term. Our task is not to blithely obey, but to see and hear and understand and live aligned with the deepest, truest, and best that we can perceive and imagine. And we don't have to do that from 501 South Mendenhall Street. In fact, that may well be our task in the coming months, as we will likely be vacating this building for a period of time. So I don't think it's true that decline in religion hurts self-government. In fact, the embrace of bad religion is a contagion, which itself does great harm to self-government. Here's what I remember about the essence of Jesus' message: heal the sick, feed the hungry, care for the weakest among us, and always pray in private. I believe our helping each other live with those teachings in mind has always been a principal goal of this gathering. That goal remains today and will remain as we reimagine our lives together through the transitions which lie ahead. May it always be so. Mm-hmm.
This is a song by the great, late Guy Clark. A little bit about, you know, not giving up on dreams and that sort of thing. Years old with a flour sack cape tied all around his neck. He climbed up on the garage, figuring what the heck. He screwed his courage up so tight the whole thing came unwound. He got a running start, and bless his heart, he headed for the ground. Well, he's one of those who knows that life is just a leap of faith. Spread your arms and hold your breath and always trust your case. Now he's all grown up with a flower sack cape tied all around his dreams. And he's full of piss and vinegar, busting at the seams. So he licked his finger and checked the wind. It's gonna be do or die. He wasn't scared of nothing, boys. He was pretty sure he could fly. Well, he's one of those who knows that life is just a leap of faith. Spread your arms and hold your breath and always trust your case. He's old and gray with a flour sack cape tied all around his head. He's still jumping off the garage and will be till he's dead. All these years the people said he's acting like a kid. He did not know he could not fly, so he did. Well, he's one of those who knows that life is just a leap of faith. Spread your arms and hold your breath and always trust your cape. He's one of those who knows that life is just a leap of faith. Spread your arms and hold your breath and always trust your cape.
Thank you.
That is quite possibly my favorite Guy Clark song.
Oh.
Time to turn inward. Go to that place you go for a moment of meditation, introspection. Some people call it prayer. I'm going to share with you something from Mark's book that seems appropriate for today. And it's the title of this meditation is On the Past, Present, and Future. Sometimes we get so caught up in planning the future and remembering the past that we miss opportunities in the here and now. Rather than focusing on the realities of now, we concentrate on skewed memories of what was or hopeful projections of what could be. Let us be called to each moment. May we stay aware of how the past informs them and be reminded of how, when stitched together in just the right way, they can create a better future. May we never gaze on the past or the future so steadily that we lose the opportunity of living in and experiencing love in each moment. Instead, let us be inspired to honor our past by carving out new and creative futures through the choices we make each day. Let us encourage, embolden, and empower each other to have the perseverance to practice love, even if doing so sometimes makes us feel uncomfortable, unsure, or unstable, simply because we are uncertain of what the outcome might look like. Let us learn to prize the journey and the love shared, trusting in the love more and more each time as we more fully embrace each moment and live in it. Amen. I will steal Mark's blessing and share this with you. May you walk in harmony with each other and with creation, and recognizing that we are one. And may you know love and kindness and happiness throughout your life. And may your words and actions help bring that love and happiness to all those you meet. And I will add, may you live a life that if it were made into a book, it would be banned in Florida. Go in peace.